Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Jeremy Adams. How are
Chris,
you?
How's it going, man?
I'm very good here. We're in the Dutch Courage Bar in Brisbane in Fortitude Valley.
That's where we are indeed, yeah.
It's one of the trendy areas in Brisbane.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, not quite trendy.
No,
it is.
All types welcome, I'd say. Certainly some trendy cats and some people who are...
just enjoying themselves.
Yeah, just enjoying themselves.
And you're a specialist gin bar, aren't you?
We are. So, to my knowledge, that back bar behind us has something like the second largest concentration of gin in the Southern Hemisphere. Yeah.
How many gins have you got?
Look, man, obviously with some of the real treats... It's sort of depending on supply and demand, but any given week, probably anywhere between 100 and 120 gins on the back by individual
products. That's
quite
good going, isn't it? Yeah, that's fabulous.
Yeah. It's the adequate amount to be going on with. Keeps us busy.
Okay. What we're going to do today is talk a wee bit about gin.
Absolutely.
I'm quite interested in the way you've structured your gin menu as well, and maybe some of the things you can do with gin.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what is gin, basically?
So essentially the... your classic definition of gin is any distilled spirit wherein the dominant flavor is that of juniper berry.
Juniper, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's lots of different ways of getting that juniper into it, isn't there?
Absolutely, there are. So, you know, classically, you take your neutral grain spirit or your...
vodka,
or the
really.
Yeah. Essentially vodka, sometimes almost an unaged whiskey, if you will. Sometimes a grape spirit. We've got things on apple up there, for God's sakes, as well. But yeah, so classically, your nice clean canvas of a spirit, and then you put that through your still again, including your juniper, obviously, that's the essential one, and then any of your other botanicals that you want to feature in your gin as well. What comes out at the end is essentially your gin, often diluted slightly to a bottling strength, put in the bottle, mix with tonic.
Yeah, yeah. And the still is a pot still, isn't it, as opposed to sort of the continuous stills they use?
Sometimes is the answer. So again, you know what really, one of the things I really love about gin is that it's not bound by as many strictures and regulations as a category as the whole. So therefore, you know, it becomes a really diverse category, wherein you have, you know, so you have some of your classic, really clean, almost vodka-like London dries, in which case you're looking at a column or continuous still. Then you have your heavier bodied, funkier. So a lot of the really stylish gins these days made by expert whiskey distillers. A great example being like the Botanist from Scotland, the people who make Brookletty whiskey. Obviously, they use the same still for their gin as they do for their whiskey. So that's a nice big funky old style beast of a pot still.
Yeah. And there's two, well, I always think of gin as three, well, three, there's probably more than three categories, isn't there? There's the Geneva gin, which is almost like an unaged whiskey, isn't it?
Yeah, so your Geneva, yeah, it's essentially sometimes even mildly aged. So you have within the Geneva, which is obviously the Dutch sort of predecessor to gin.
Yep, and that's where you're called Dutch Courage, isn't it?
And that, that's exactly where we come from. If you'd like, later on we can get into the history of exactly why the courage is Dutch,
yeah,
and where it comes from. But yeah, so essentially your Geneva, you have your Ute and your Jung, so young and old varieties. Your Ute is not aged as much as, you know, we're looking at like a single malt where everything is dominated by the wood. But yeah, a touch of fresh oak in that case. And that gives you pretty much a barley wine, which happens to have some juniper in it. And then your unaged one, which is, as you say, almost a gin with that very usually not as diverse a range of botanicals in it, just a massive juniper punch and a very sort of oily, mouth-coating, thick, viscous...
They are quite oily, aren't they?
Very much so, yeah. So,
whenever I've given people, I think it's Bowles Geneva.
Bowles Geneva is the one, at least over here in Australia, which sort of most people will be able to give a nod to and say, yes, I recognize what that is. Otherwise, you're pretty much looking at a little sneaky something in the bag on the way back from Holland is almost the only way for us to get the good stuff.
Much.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've got the cheaper styles of gin. Well, quite often they're cold compounding, isn't it?
Where
you
get. So obviously Gordon's is your go-to sort of like...
is that cold compounding?
I believe. There's another one. I mean, it's not... not per se a bad thing, the cold compounding, but certainly it's not as artisanal. So it seems it's almost, you know, a slightly more artificial, not as much trial and error type way to get your flavor profile together.
And what's cold compounding in a nutshell?
Yeah, so cold compounding is essentially in place of, as I say, that traditional method of siphoning through your neutral spirit as it is distilled again through a big botanical basket or individual baskets of botanicals. So then cold compounding instead is essentially taking your neutral grain spirit and then adding essentially what
oils.
Would be, oils, extremely concentrated flavor essences in a neutral spirit again. So it's essentially, you know, instead of making your gin and it's one product coming out at the end of the still, you're sort of almost assembling your gin out of little Lego blocks of essentially powerful chemical flavor concentrates.
Yeah, and you can do it cold, so I suppose that's
exactly
why it's cold.
It's cold because you're not evaporating through past the botanical basket as you would with a straightforward vapor infusion one shot production method.
So let's quickly go through that vapor infusion one shot. You've got a pot still of some sort.
Yeah, so you've got your pot still, very much the same as you'd use for any other spirit, your whiskeys, your rums, so on
brandy,
and so forth.
Yeah.
All usually in pot stills. Basically, where the difference comes in with gin is in the middle of that pot still, right in the neck, where the vapor runs past immediately after the spirit has been heated, and therefore the alcohol evaporates before, you know, you get your water and everything coming through. So you have this basket, almost like a, if you think of like the large, like a tea bag almost.
Yeah, yeah.
That holds everything that's going to impart flavor into your finished product. So obviously, as we said, juniper berries, often your citrus, your angelica root, your orris, and then obviously the sky's the limit with that. Cucumber, rose, not naming any names, but yeah. As that vapor streams past your botanicals, obviously it strips out some of the essential oils, the flavor program. The flavor molecules, so on and so forth, and when that vapor recondenses, much the same as the steam. You know, when you're steaming veggies, it carries some of that flavor. That flavor recondenses and is indeed infused into the spirit.
And that's your gin.
And that's your gin. Yeah.
Some people call that a Carter head still.
Okay. Yeah.
It's just a technical name for it. Mm-mm. But some other people make gin by just getting your pot still, not putting it in a tea bag, as you said, or a basket, but just putting all the stuff into the
into the big pot,
isn't it?
And it's just making a big stock or something, and then getting condensing at the end. Yeah.
So you've got your cold compounding. And
yeah.
We've described the method of gin production, but there is a big difference between, say, a London dry gin, and a standard gin, really, isn't it?
I've mentioned earlier about one of the things which appeals to me is the diverse nature of gin and the fact that it's not governed by as many strictures as many of your other spirits, which have, you know, origins of appellation or strict guidelines on what can be added and what not can't be added at a certain process. Now, your London Dry is sort of the prototypical exception to that quality for gin. So London Dry obviously is essentially gin as you and I and particularly my grandmother know it. It's your Gordons, your Bombay Sapphires, your Tanqueray's. And essentially, so London Dry is the Scotch whiskey of gin, and that it's, with the exception of your water post-distillation, the tiniest bit of sweetness, I believe it's something like 0.01% of a gram, something like that, you can add post-distillation, so, you know, an almost completely invisible, intangible amount. And the fact, again, that your London Dry gin is all made in that one pot method, so not assembled piecemeal.
You're not allowed to add anything.
Yeah.
Because quite often you see gins and they add cucumber after distillation and
exactly,
things like that, whereas they can't be a London Dry, can they?
No, they can't. So your London Dry or your rare dry gins, you know, if it's made elsewhere in the world, in Australia, so here we're... it's made elsewhere in the world other than the UK. So we have a shelf of like lovely artisanal Australian products on the back bar, and they will say, you know, rare Australian dry gin.
That rare dry gin,
in many other country acts as that same sort of qualifier, saying no additional sweeteners. We haven't played with it beyond dilution after it's come off the still.
So we've done the cold compounding, we've done the Carter still, we've done all the main methods of production.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've got gin now.
Now we're getting to the freaky stuff. Yeah,
what are we going to do with it?
I thought that might be where we were going. First place everyone starts, and for a lot of people, the reason you don't go back to it after that first sip of the stolen Gordons and tonic is your G&T. So,
gin and tonic. Oh, gin and I like tonic. Gin and tonic. Yeah,
so do I, as it happens. What are the chances? Standing here in Dutch Courage that people would be into their G&Ts. But look, that's
is it not very popular? You know,
oh no, it's pretty popular. That was a bit of sarcasm there. Like, oh, okay. yeah, look, your gin and tonic for me is to be honest, a beautifully you know, adaptable sort of. It's not a smoky Scotch whiskey or a heavy chewy Bordeaux or something like that. You can have a gin and tonic in the afternoon, before a meal, after a meal, during a meal, with friends, with mum, with grandma, that sort of thing. It's great sort of any time drink.
What's the perfect mixture, right? Because I've traded around with
look, you know, whatever I say here, there's going to be somebody who does a double spit take and sort of curses my name. I've talked to various characters who are sort of very, very hard line about anything from you know, half tonic to the amount of gin on the really sort of grit your, like, take the hair off your chest end. The average agreement seems to be, you know, between equal parts and one part gin to two parts tonic.
Obviously, because I make it 1-4.
Yeah, all right, well, there you are, you know. And but, you know, obviously there's a massive remove in that. And again, I guess it depends on exactly the products you're using. So, you know, a supermarket sort of off-brand tonic water with the artificial sweeteners and the synthesized quinine, everything like that.
Yep.
Is gonna start to really mess with your gin at the sort of like 1-6, 1-8 end of the spectrum, which is often what you'll get if you rock down to the pub and you get your tall gin tonic and there's little just tiny bit down the bottom and then just the post mix gun keeps going and going and going. Myself, yeah, I probably sit around a little bit more of the dilution spectrum. I like to drink usually like a overproof or navy strength gin and my tonic personally.
Yeah, yeah. What's navy strength? About 60%, is it?
Yeah, yeah. So again, some slight fluctuation, but yeah, usually about 64-67%. Particular examples on the back bar range from we've got an original make of the West Winds overproof, which sits at 72.5, and that's really the ridiculous point. But yeah, so your navy strength or gunpowder strength should be at least above 60. That's where that gunpowder aspect comes in. That's sort of the proof that you need in order to be able to ignite at room temperature, and spark your gunpowder. Yeah.
You're saying that the navy strength stuff, it can actually light gunpowder.
Yeah, so its other name, I guess, with the same historical background is that gunpowder proof instead of navy strength, and that was because gin at one point, you know, along with rum, was the all important booze ration, the grog for the sailors.
Yep.
And so at one point in the Royal Navy, you were issued with up to 1.5 pints of, you know, sort of bathtub rock gut gin at some point just to keep you going, keep the ship happy. Now, the problem with having all of that liquid in those casks stored on board is that it was often stored adjacent to sort of the powder room where the ship's powder for firing the cannons,
yeah,
etc.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so if those casks broke and saturated the gunpowder, you know, it was pretty much you were screwed, unless it was gunpowder strength gin, so at a high enough ABV that it would still ignite nice and freely at room temperature, in which case you can just take your wet handful of gunpowdery mac and boom,
still fire,
spark, yeah. and it would still fire. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Oh, excellent. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right then, mate, I think we're going to wrap it up there.
Yeah,
thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for your time, mate.
Cheers, bud. Cheers.